Welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, and we broadcast 5 days a week, 2 hours a day on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We film a webcam of the show and upload those after the day is over to Mr. News Guerrilla Media, the YouTube channel, which has, and the New Zealand listeners will love this, more subscribers than the New Zealand Herald TV channel, which is undoubtedly the largest mainstream media source on the web in New Zealand. And I'm beating them by myself, because that is how much popularity the truth truly has. You're either involved deeply in this movement, or you're really not involved at all. My very special guest is the illustrious and various other nice adjectives guest, G. Edward Griffin. A lot of people ask what the G stands for. It stands for George. His father and his grandfather before him were named George as well. He kind of got tired of that tradition, so he kind of goes by Ed. Welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, that's quite true. Not many people know that the real moniker is George.
Yeah. See, I'd always thought that it just was just for being just so straight gangster that you just go by G. But
yeah,
it's not the case.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, a little small kid, they had a little song they sang. You know, Georgie, Porgy, Puddin' and Pie, kissed the girls and made them cry. And when the boys came out to play, Georgie Porgy ran away. And I hated that song. So if anybody started to call me George, I made it very clear to them that my name was Edward.
Well, you must have been a real heartbreaker back in the day, man.
What?
You must have been a real heartbreaker, you know, a real hit with the ladies.
Oh, I broke my own heart many times, I know that.
Well, so thinking about this in terms of relationship, are you married?
Oh, yes, yes. I've been married to the same woman for over 50 years.
I had this conversation the other day with Pastor Lindsay Williams and a Wall Street trader named Tom Filer. And we were talking about just when you're a man who's trying to do great things with the world, usually you cannot do it without a really supportive, loving partner who's really with you step by step, every step of the way. When you're single or promiscuous or something of that nature, the safety and security of a strong, faithful relationship just isn't there.
It sure is a great help, and you've heard it said 1,000 times, and I believe it's true, and I'll say it too. I could not have done it alone. Not that the it is anything in particular, but I don't think I could have had a contented, self-fulfilled life. And I agree with you totally. I think one is half a number.
Hmm. I am really concerned, though, about a lot of other people that are along the same vein of thought that we have, who are in relationships that the other half of their relationship doesn't get it, is still asleep, as it were. And I couldn't imagine what kind of a pain and frustration that would be. I've never had to deal with that.
Yeah, the pain and frustration of what, Vinny? I missed that.
Of being with somebody who just doesn't get it.
I see what you mean. That would be very, very difficult. I know many people who are in that situation, and I can tell you, from what I can see, it's a great strain on everybody, and often it leads to a breakup.
Yeah, you know, this whole idea about waking people up, I'm of the opinion, Ed, that you can't wake people up. they wake themselves up. Nobody forced me to watch 100 documentaries and radically alter my worldview over a period of a few months, did they? You know,
yeah.
There's certain people out there who provide, you know, waking up information, but you can't force people into it. And even if you could, you wouldn't want to, because it goes against the very principle of trying to free people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I often get a kick out of people. They're paying me a compliment, and I take it as such, but they'll write me a letter and they say, this book, I just finished reading your book, Mr. Griffin, and I think this ought to be compulsory reading in all the schools. And I'm thinking to myself, I better go back and read it again. Because I don't believe in compulsion.
What about recommended reading?
I'd like that. Yeah, strongly recommended reading, but not compulsory.
Yeah. I mean, and if it is compulsory, what are you going to do? Mark people down on it, just like, you haven't read G. Edward Griffin's book, this, that, or the other, you know?
Yeah. And I understand. It's just a word. There are many different levels of compulsion. I get it. You know, when you send kids to school, you know, they have compulsory reading, and that's part. I go along with that. Or they're not going to get through the class, you know. But that's what they're talking about. But I laugh at the word, because I spend a lot of my verbal time and digital time talking about the evils of compulsion. But, of course, I'm talking about at the political level, not at the educational level.
Yeah. You have a conversation with somebody, and it's on the points you agree that you should come together and collaborate, right? And sometimes I ask people, look, are we going to try and find a fundamental disagreement? Are you going to put on a black ski mask and invade my home or something of that nature with a police badge and beat me to death in front of my family or anything? Are you ever planning to do that? Well, no. Okay, well, then there's not really any fundamental disagreements we're really going to have on, because we both don't like the idea of forcefully punishing people. And I have this concept that's been buzzing around in my head for many years, and I kind of wanted to lay this on you, is how exactly does a human being, and this, I've seen this happen in many, many people, suddenly decide that it's just not worth it, that people deserve their fate if they don't stand up against it? You know, I've spoken to many people in the truth movement who say the sheeple deserve their fate. They deserve to be exterminated because they just don't see what's going on.
Well, I have to think about that a moment. I suppose what we're listening to is the sound of frustration. I wonder if they really mean that. I think deserve, you know, that word needs to be chewed on a little bit. Do any of us deserve anything that good happens to us, you know? If there's a lot of luck that plays into that. You can climb to the top of the philosophical mountain with that word and ask, what do we deserve because of our own intrinsic worthiness and so forth? And if you want to follow that path, you usually come to the end of it and you say, well, we don't deserve anything, because it was just all good fortune or because of our Creator or whatever. But in a different sense, yeah, people do deserve the results of their own actions. If they choose to do foolish things, they should expect foolish results. And so if they expect other results, they don't deserve it in that sense. I think that that expression, I even found myself saying it at one point in my evolution, and I stopped and analyzed it, and I said, you know, this is frustration. I'm angry with these people. I'm angry with them. And then I began to analyze it. You know, why am I angry with them? It's because I'm expecting too much from them. I think that if I were in their exact same shoes, with exactly the same upbringing and the same influences in my early years and family and everything, there's a good chance I'd be exactly the same as they are. I know that's the old argument between, you know, what's ingrained, what's genetic, and what's culture, the difference between culture and nature and so forth. But I think we are mostly what we are, mostly, not entirely, because of our environment, how we were fortunate enough to be or unfortunate enough to be raised, and our role models, the people we were accidentally thrown in with, all of those things. And then I finally top off all that reasoning with the idea that we were talking about this earlier. Only 3% of the population will ever see it, ever get it, will ever assume that it's their responsibility to change anything. Most people are just going to be followers, and they will go wherever the leadership segment of society leads them. And so once I keep thinking back on that, and I came to the conclusion, well, okay, there are some people that are going to get it and some people that aren't. Most of them are not. And I don't necessarily say that that's their fault. That, you know, I'm not firm on that part of it, by the way. Maybe it is their fault. But I prefer to think they just happen to be in that 97% of the population, and that's too bad for them. Now, what I need to do is find somebody in that 3% and contract with them. Let's work together. Let's talk with them and form some kind of movement. And now we can change the world.
You know, that's quite an interesting way of looking at it, because I'm sure that during your time on this earth doing all these things you have done, you've incurred a lot of abuse, criticism, ridicule. We all do. We've all gone through it. And the way I've chosen to deal with it is to take all that abuse, ridicule, and criticism, take the bits from it that I feel are true. Yes, I have been a bit arrogant. Yes, I have been a bit flippant. Maybe I haven't done enough research or something of that nature. And then I'll discard the rest, because as soon as that person's abuse is really their only motivation, I realize that there's 7 billion people on the planet. I'd rather hang out with the very small minority of people who actually get me, who can actually help me, who actually inspire me. Not you, sir. Yeah, I think well, this is about sorting the chaff from the wheat.
A perfectly natural and normal and healthy attitude. It's at the root of the word to discriminate. You choose to discriminate. People say, you mustn't discriminate. Well, that's stupid. To discriminate means to choose. To choose that which you prefer, it doesn't mean you have to be negative. People immediately think, racial discrimination means, they think, it means that you dislike a race. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. It may be true in some cases, but it's not true, I believe, in most cases. But you discriminate among your friends. People hang out generally with those of their same age. They discriminate against people who are very, very younger than they are, very older than they. They hang out with people of the same attitudes, the same sense of humor, the same preferences in music and in humor. They hang out with the same people and have the same hobbies, same language, same culture. I mean, this is natural. There's nothing unethical about discriminating as long as you're not discriminating against somebody because of something that we choose to set our limits on that. We believe that you should not discriminate against a person because of their race, and I believe that totally. But I think you should discriminate against a person because of something that they believe or their character. If they're a thief, if they're liars, if they're untrustworthy, if they have a criminal mind, if they're brutes, if they beat little children and women, you better discriminate against them. So I guess my little plea here, and I got off on a shoot, is just that we need to be careful when we use the word to discriminate, because I think we all should be more discriminate than we are. And that all started with your comment that you like to hang out with people that think along the same lines you do. And I say, hooray for you. And we all should do that.
And ironically, the way I think is completely out of control. There's no topic I won't broach. It's just I like to be honorable and friendly. I mean, really, that's it. You hit on something right there that is absolutely 100% on the money. It is not the color of somebody's skin. It is not the content of one's bank account. It is the quality of one's character.
Exactly.
That's what you discriminate on.
You should.
And if you don't, imagine the scum that you'll surround yourself with.
That's right. Well, whenever a boy and a girl get together and decide to be boyfriends and girlfriends or husband and wife, they sure expect their partner to discriminate, don't they? They say, you're mine, nobody else's. Agreed or not, and you better be discriminate.
See, and another thing, you know, like when the collectivists discriminate or something, I've had so many people, like, I tell really bad jokes, Ed. I mean, I must admit. And every now and again, I'll mention a group that perhaps have been discriminated against or something of that nature, not to insult them or anything like that, usually in the context of insulting something else. And I'll have somebody come up and violently, aggressively tell me that I shouldn't discriminate against these other kind of people. And it's like, well, hold on a second. I was doing something out of good humor, maybe in bad taste, and you're getting violent with me over it? I think you're overreacting. And you're taking yourself and or life far too seriously. Those are the things that I believe are the two immutable rules for living a happy life and not taking yourself down really dark paths of anger and rage and aggression and self-denial and hate. Don't take yourself too seriously, and don't take what other people say to you personally.
Yeah, it's easier said than done sometimes, isn't it? Especially if the other person is someone whom you admire and or is very close to you, then it gets a little more difficult to be above it all. But still, that doesn't negate the advice that you just gave, because it's certainly good advice. And even among those friends of yours, it's good advice. It's just harder to follow.
Well, I think most things in life are easier said than done.
Yes, all the good things.
Yeah, that's right. The bad things are really easy to get into, you know, and they're easy to maintain. The good things, on the other hand, they're freaking near on impossible to build, almost impossible to start, and yet we keep doing them anyway through persistence, vision, things, all those good things. And I think that if you do want to live a happy life, take the hard road, because the easy road doesn't prove a hell of a lot. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. The Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the Chateau de Rothschild on the sacrificial lamb, nice, beautiful barbecue area that we have for all the children that we sacrificed. I'm a very special guest who's a connoisseur of fine New York style kebabs and pizzas. It's G. Edward Griffin, a man with the plan and the philosophy and intelligence that we may need to overthrow organized crime in our time. Mr. Griffin, welcome back.
Thank you, Godfather. So nice to be back.
I was hoping that song would play, because I always do the Godfather impression thing, and I think we did that the first time we have. Yeah, I like the Godfather. I do. Anyway, I've been conscious of the fact during this interview, I've been trying to share with you some of my personal philosophies, and I don't think that's really what this really should be about, because I don't get to speak to you very often, and there is a lot of things that you've done in your life that are so important, that have realizations that really change perspectives for people in and of their entirety. And you've been around many years, Ed. What are some of the most important lessons that you've really discovered in your lifetime that you would wish for future generations to hold on to?
Well, that's a great question. It's a huge question. It opens up in all directions, doesn't it? I would almost beg off on that because I would like to have time to think about it. But, you know, there's certain things that come to mind that are pretty obvious. Most of my mental activity has been spent in political and economic and social affairs with a strong secondary interest in health matters, and because those are the things I've written about. So you can kind of divide that all up. Are we talking about politics and social issues or monetary issues, human relationships, which is another category? Are we talking about health? And I think that everybody has their insights based on their own personal experiences about what to do, how to handle personal relationships. But the thing that I feel that I have a little edge over the average has to do with the political, the economic, and certainly the health issues, because I've had more time to pursue those, to read and research. It's like I've been in a lifelong class, like I'm enrolled in college ever since I was 20 years old, and I just keep going to class every day. And, you know, I realize that most people aren't that fortunate. They can't do that. They've got a life to live. They've got a job to pursue, a family to raise, and all of that. And fortunately for me, that's been part of my profession. It's been how I pursue a job. And so I'd like to just focus on that for a minute. In the field of health, the most important lesson I learned early on was that health doesn't come from the pharmaceutical industry. That optimum health is really something that the body itself creates if you give it a chance. You've got a commercial on one of your sponsors there, by one of your sponsors, that says it pretty well. The body will heal itself. It just needs a little help. I would not have used the word help. What it needs are raw materials, you know. It's like a machine that makes cement. It needs to have sand and rock and some certain chemicals. It just needs the raw materials, and it'll make cement. But it was almost a shock to me to realize that all the dread diseases that we think about, the chronic diseases like cancer and arthritis and heart disease and all of the big killers, they're not caused by a deficiency of some drug. They're caused usually by a deficiency of some nutritional element that, for one reason or another, individuals are no longer getting an adequate supply. It may be because they have a lousy diet, because they're eating all these processed foods, the easy foods that are so easy to come by, but in the path of processing them, so many of these little micronutrients have been removed. Or maybe they're eating nice fresh vegetables and all of that sort of thing, but the vegetables are coming from land that has been tilled and producing those same crops for 80 or 100 years. And with each passing year, a little more of those micronutrients, you know, things like selenium that you never think about, are being drawn out of the soil and put into the food and hauled off into market and not replaced. Maybe the fertilizers that the farmers are putting down contain a lot of good things, phosphates, you know, some minerals, but not those little trace minerals. They're gradually being depleted. And so even people who are eating fresh vegetables thinking, I'm eating healthy, are gradually, with the passage of time, being exposed to lower and lower levels of essential trace minerals. So when that picture finally got clearly implanted in my brain, I would call it a real epiphany. It was a complete change in how I viewed seeking medical advice and medical help. It used to be that I would say, well, let's find a doctor. You know, what does the doctor say? And then further research in terms of cancer, I found out that what the doctor says is what the doctor is taught, And what the doctor is taught, it comes from the curricula, which is determined by the donors of the money to the universities that teach the doctor. And those donors, for the large part, either are or are part of the pharmaceutical industry. So I found out, much to my amazement, that doctors are heavily biased in favor of pharmaceuticals rather than nutrition. Man-made chemicals with patents on them that can be very profitable. And that the whole medical profession is geared in the direction of making people feel better after they have become ill. And notice I said feel better. I didn't say cure them, but feel better, because the medical profession treats symptoms. They don't necessarily are concerned about what the cause of this disease, as long as they can treat the symptoms and make you feel better and keep you on the drug for the rest of your life to feel better. Well, all of that, that was a very profound awakening for me, and I think it might have had something to do with my health. I'm pretty healthy for my age. Fortunately, I'm sure luck has had a lot to do with it, and my wife has been a great teacher and cook and nutritionist, and she's kept me on the straight path with a good diet and all of that. But part of it was my own awareness that you just don't go running to the doctor for a new drug every time you've got a cramp or a pain or a headache or something like that. So we'll just start with that one. Vinny, I would say that general awareness that health comes from nature, that it's a balance between the mechanisms of the body that you're born with and the input of certain basic raw materials, many of which are chemicals which we don't even think about. You know, they're trace minerals, and particularly. And enzymes. Sometimes we don't even have the enzymes that we're supposed to have because the food is too cooked and all the enzymes in the food are gone. Or because we've put food through the microwave, and the microwave process destroys the enzymes and to some extent even changes the chemical composition of the food itself. So, again, I'm kind of going over the same ground. The more I learned that health, optimum health, I believe, comes from nature and the body's balance with nature, that was perhaps one of the biggest discoveries of my life and has had one of the biggest and the most profound effects on my life.
I was just thinking about what you're saying about enzymes there. I came up with another bad joke. Maybe you should write a book called The Enzyme Prophecies.
Well, there's some very good books out there on enzymes. As a matter of fact, if any of your listeners are interested, they should come to our website, our Reality Zone website, and go to the health section. And you'll find a couple of excellent treatises on the role of enzymes, the variety of them, and especially on how easily they can be disabled through processing. And, of course, how to replace them, how to find healthy replacements for them.
I do recognize this, that almost everything that everybody consumes on a daily basis has gone through an enormous amount of processing, and it has almost nothing to do with food. What we consume nowadays is not food. It's food-like products.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Well, what can I say? I think everybody's vaguely aware of this, but maybe they need to think about it a little bit more to come to that kind of an epiphany that I had some years ago, so that I realized that this was not just a little exceptional coincidence here and there, but this was universal across the board and affecting our lives in so many ways. If they want to live an optimum life, I think they better get hip on that.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I've always thought that health is one of the most important things, because what do people say when you're down on your luck and you've pretty much lost everything? What do they say?
Yeah,
well,
of course, they always
at least you still have your health. And yet, everybody worries about their health, and worry causes stress, which causes detrimental health effects.
Right.
Yeah. We live an ironic existence, don't we? And also, I wanted to ask you as well about just in terms of political ideology, which do you think is the most dangerous specifically, and maybe a historic example, versus what, in your opinion, might be the most promising example of a political ideology that works?
Well, yeah, that's the other area where there was a huge epiphany, and that, of course, it's hard to put in a bottle. It's hard to describe. It's hard to put just one word to it. But I'll try, and as best as I can describe it, it's an awareness of what are the ingredients that must go into a social contract one with the other. When people live together, they come to, their culture comes to sort of an understanding of what is the right way to live with each other, what are the things that should not be done, should be done. That's our culture, and some cultures have a lot more freedom in them than others, and but they're not. It's not just one thing. So it's sort of a potpourri of different relationships and different rules and different limits and so forth. But I finally boiled it down some years ago to this contest between the ideology of collectivism on the one hand and individualism on the other. And each of those has their own each of those points of view is based upon a series of subcomponents of concepts, and they're found in both sides of the debate, except they're 180 degrees out of phase with each other. And there aren't many of them. And it's something I think that the average grade school student could understand fairly well. Certainly a high school student would have no trouble with it. I'll give you just an example. The basic philosophy that divides these two camps is the role of the individual versus the group. And that's kind of implied by the word collectivism versus individualism. You can see right away where the division is. Collective involves the group, and individuals involve the individual, which is supreme, which is the highest unit of society. And collectivists believe that the group is more important than the individual, and that the individual must be sacrificed, if necessary, for the greater good of the greater number. To them, it's a numbers game. It's majority rules, all of these things we hear. It's the basis of democracy. If you've got a larger number, then you win. It doesn't make a difference what you do. You can do anything as long as you've got a larger number. And that's the basis of collectivism. Whereas individualists believe that the group doesn't even exist, when you think about it. There's no such thing as a group. Group is just a word. It's an abstraction. It's in the mind. It's an abstraction for the concept, the mental vision of many individuals. But group doesn't exist. It's a mathematical concept. You can touch individuals, but you can't touch a group. It's like the word forest. You can touch trees, but you can't touch a forest, because that's a mathematical concept, an abstraction. And so here's the division. Here we got the collectivists that say the group is the most important element of society, when group doesn't even exist. Individualists say, well, what really exists is the individual, and that's the building block of society. And what is truly good for the greater good of the greater number, truly, is what is good for the individual. That's how you come up with it. Anyway, this is it's something worth a lot of thought, and any high school students for sure can get these concepts, but they have to be brought up in discussion. They should be part of our historical process of learning our history, learning where America came from, because when America was founded, it was a break from the traditions of the past. America, as far as I can tell, is the first nation.
I'm sorry, Ed, we're coming to break, unfortunately. We'll come back from break and let you finish your point.
To fly to New Zealand by plane from New York City, it takes 22 hours. So from the Twin Cities, 19. I mean, I fly all
Welcome
the time.
Welcome back, everybody.
And 6 hours on a plane is like a lot, and 19 is...
Welcome back to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com 5 days a week. Now, G. Edward Griffin is my guest, and what's incidental about this is that we just got ourselves a new kitten, and he's ginger, and his name's Griffin. So I'm not sure if you can hear the purring.
But
it was kind of named after you, and also the mythological beast that that eats people.
Oh, well, let's hope it's the latter and not the former.
I was thinking of trying to train him to hiss at financiers and scratch collectivists, you know.
Yeah, right. So, well, anyway, I was taking too long to cover that ground. I think probably many of your listeners are very familiar with this, but the bottom line is that once it became clear in my mind that all of this hoopla, this political discussion and debate and argument and contest can be boiled down to a very simple concept, and that's the differences between collectivism and individualism, it became a lot easier to deal with issues, because when you apply the issues against these basic principles, there are no exceptions. They always can be resolved by what your political view, or your ideological views, really, I should call them, what your views are on that issue. If you're clear on that, then making a decision is really easy. You can cut through all the smoke and all the lies.
You know, there was a phrase, I can't remember what it is, but a republic is where 99% of the people cannot vote away the rights of the other 1%. In a democracy, 51% of the people can vote away the rights of the other 49%.
Yeah, that's about it. Mm-hmm. The analogy I like to use is a lynch mob. Now, people who believe in majority rule and don't want any further discussion of it then should certainly have no objection to a lynch mob, because there's only one dissenting vote, and he's at the end of the rope. So there you have it. But if you say, well, wait a minute, even that one individual, even if that mob out there is totally convinced that he's guilty of some heinous crime, even so, that individual is entitled to a fair trial, a conviction by a jury of his peers and so forth, if that, in fact, is what was written into the Constitution. So republics always have constitutions. They have, in other words, republics have a set of rules, written rules, limitations on what the majority can do. That's what it's all about. And in the United States, that was embedded into our form of law when we had the Bill of Rights, which said that, you know, Congress shall pass no law restricting the rights, peaceful assembly, the right to bear arms, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, and so forth. No law, meaning the majority shall not restrict in any way these things. Well, that's quite a difference. And how many political systems of the world were launched on that concept? And there are not many of them. As far as I know, the United States was the only one. Well, with the passage of time, Americans have lost any memory of those concepts. And unfortunately, many of them have lost any interest in those concepts. We've been put through a government school system. Now we come out thinking that majority should rule, and then if a president or a political party can win the election, then all bets are off. That president or that political party can do whatever it wants to do. Don't even ask about rights or limitations. Hey, they won the election, didn't they? You see? Well, that's why so many of the founding fathers in America predicted that if they ever created a democracy, and they warned against it, they were not creating a democracy. They said democracies always destroy themselves. Democracies always end up in the tyranny of the mob. And they were right. So Americans have never heard of that. Most of them lost interest in it and so forth. But anyway, that's our task, is to rekindle an awareness and an appreciation for these principles. And it can be done. I see it being done. And if there's any one good thing that one can say about what's happening in the world today, that things are going so badly for so many people that it's catching their attention, and they're noticing, and they're beginning to think about these issues. And let's hope that enough of them will catch fire with the fire of liberty, the spark of liberty, that they'll actually want to become active in politics to move into the political arena themselves and to pull away control from the collectivists that so far have had an easy going of it. They've had no contest. Nobody's ever tried to unseat them. When you think about it, how many individualists have ever run for office? You know, individualists like you and like me, we tend to say, politics, it's dirty. Who wants to mess with that, you know? Leave people alone. Well, we run out of time for that philosophy because when individualists stay out of the battle, that means there's no contest. That means the collectivists just move in easily. And that's why in every government in the world today, you'll find they're run by collectivists without exception.
Now, you were talking there about the idea of the mob, and you also mentioned the right to bear arms. And there was a story that I heard of a lynch mob that was about to lynch a black slave in a small American town, and a 14-year-old girl with a pistol that she didn't even know how to use held the mob at bay and saved his life.
Well, it's a great story. I hope it's true. That's the way it should be, you know? That's the way it should be. Guns, in my opinion, how many times have I said it? I don't know. But anyway, guns are dangerous. Guns scare me. The only thing more dangerous than having guns is not having them when you need them. It's that simple. Guns are not a problem in society. If everybody had a gun, we'd have less crime than we have today. I remember reading a very scholarly paper. Was produced by some graduate student at a Midwestern university, I believe it was, about gun violence in the pioneer West. And much to everybody's surprise, the statistics that he dug out of those old records was that the pioneer West in America was a very law-abiding place to be because everybody had a gun strapped on their hip. And, yeah, we've seen a lot of Hollywood movies, you know, about the showdown at the OK Corral and these guys walking in the saloons and shooting each other up and all that sort of thing. Most of that was Hollywood. When everybody was armed, there weren't so many criminals walking around shooting things up because everybody else would shoot back and they'd be dead. They knew that. So, anyway.
That was the reason why Jesse James and Billy the Kid became famous because they managed to pull off more than one crime before being killed.
Exactly. And they had a pretty good gang too, and also I believe if you go back and look at the record of Jesse James and Billy the Kid, the areas where they were most successful was where the population had pretty well disarmed. They had already, you know, said, "Oh well, we got a sheriff now. We'll let the sheriff take care of it." Well, sheriff can't take care of it with 30 guys right into the town on horseback and loaded, you know, ready to go. That's where you need everybody armed. So, anyway, I don't know how we got started on that, except to say that one person with a gun, like that little 14-year-old girl you mentioned, can save a life and can prevent an injustice. We don't get the stories. Every day, somewhere in America, there's a story of someone preventing a crime because they were armed, preventing the loss of a life. Every day, I'm sure. That's got to be true. If not every day, pretty close to it. As you said before, statistics, 99% of all statistics are made up. But we know, I mean, I see the stories coming through at the alternate media, not in the major press. We know that people are preventing crimes and saving lives with guns every day, but we don't read about it in the paper. All we read about it is when lives are lost because one person had a gun and nobody else did.
Yeah, that's pretty much the short and the curlies of it, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, you see Obama saying we need to take people's guns, and then you see his re-inauguration parade surrounded on all sides by armed protectors trying to convince us that we don't need guns to protect us.
Right. Well, I think people are waking up to the charade.
Let's hope so. Well, we only have about a minute or so left in the show, so if there's any final words of wisdom that you'd like to bestow either on me or on the audience,
I don't know.
Go for your life.
If you just take the word wisdom off, it'd be easier. Well, the final word I'd like to leave with you, Vinny, is that I want to thank you for the show you've been putting on. For how many years now have you been doing this?
This is coming into the third year of doing this particular show.
Third year. And I know it takes a lot of preparation. And as you said earlier, a little bit of flack now and then. So I want to thank you for that. And keep the faith and send people out over to see us at realityzone.com and freedomforce.org. And if enough of us get together, we can literally change the world.
And it doesn't take a cast of thousands.
No, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. All right. Gia Griffin, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time today. And I know that you don't do a... I know that you're actually kind of trying to take it easy these days, and for you to come on the show is actually really, really special for me, because you're one of my heroes, essentially. And I believe that without you, this entirety of the truth movement would not exist in its current form. And I know that you've been doing it for so many years against all the odds, and still come out on top. And that is an encouraging thing.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Lenny. Benny, it's very kind of you to say that.
All right. Thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. And check out G. Edward Griffin at the websites freedomforceinternational.org and realityzone.com. I'm Vinny Eastwood, and you can check out the archives for this show at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, americanfreedomradio.com, and the webcam versions, where you'll also see the kitten behind me, at Mr. News Guerrilla Media, the YouTube channel. We'll see you again sometime.